curiously as we came through. I caught the eye of one young woman and nodded and smiled at her. Perhaps I would have a chance to come back and talk later. Her eyes widened in surprise, and she bent her head at once, eyes on the bowl of peapods in her lap. I saw her steal a quick glance at me as we crossed the long room, and noticed that she balanced the bowl in front of the small bulge of an early pregnancy. The first sick slave was in a small pantry off the kitchen itself, lying on a pallet laid under shelves stacked high with gauze-wrapped cheeses. The patient, a young man in his 20s, sat up, blinking at the sudden ray of light when I opened the door. "What's the trouble with him?" I knelt down beside the man and touched his skin. Warm, damp, no apparent fever. He didn't seem in any particular distress, merely blinking sleepily as I examined him. "He has a worm." I glanced at Geely in surprise. From what I had seen and heard so far in the islands, I thought it likely that at least 3/4 of the black population, and not a few of the whites, suffered from internal parasites. Nasty as these could be, though, most were actively threatening only to the very young and the very old. "Probably a lot more than one," I said. I pushed the slave gently onto his back and began to palpate his stomach. The spleen was tender and slightly enlarged, also a common finding here, but I felt no suspicious masses in the abdomen that might indicate a major intestinal infestation. "He seems moderately healthy. Why have you got him in here, in the dark?" As though in answer to my question, the slave suddenly wrenched himself away from my hand, let out a piercing scream, and rolled up into a ball. Rolling and unrolling himself like a yo-yo, he reached the wall and began to bang his head against it, still screaming. Then, as suddenly as the fit had come on, it passed off, and the young man sank back onto the pallet, panting heavily and soaked with sweat. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said. "What was that?" "A lower, lower one," Geely said, looking amused at my reaction. "They live in the eyeballs, just under the lining. They cross back and forth from one eye to the other, and when they go across the bridge of the nose, I'm told it's rather painful." She nodded at the slave, still quivering slightly on his pallet. "The dark keeps them from moving so much," she explained. "The fellow from Andros who told me about them says you must catch them when they've just come in one eye, for they're right near the surface, and you can lift them out with a big darning needle. If you wait, they go deeper, and you canna get them." She turned back to the kitchen and shouted for a light. "Here, I brought the needle, just in case." She groped in the bag at her waist and drew out a square of felt with a 3-inch steel needle thrust through it, which she extended helpfully to me. "Are you out of your mind?" I stared at her, appalled. "No. Did you not see you were a good healer?" she asked reasonably. "I am, but..." I glanced at the slave, hesitated, then took the candle one of the kitchen maids was holding out to me. "Bring me some brandy and a small sharp knife," I said. "Dip the knife and the needle in the brandy, then hold the tip in a flame for a moment. Let it cool, but don't touch it." As I spoke, I was gently pulling up one eyelid. The man's eye looked up at me, an oddly irregular blotched brown iris in a bloodshot sclera the yellow of heavy cream. I searched carefully, bringing the candle flame close enough to shrink the pupil, then drawing it away, but saw nothing there. I tried the other eye and nearly dropped the candle. Sure enough, there was a small transparent filament moving under the conjunctiva. I gagged slightly at the sight, but controlled myself and reached for the freshly sterilized knife, still holding back the eyelid. "Take him by the shoulders," I said to Geely. "Don't let him move, or I may blind him." The surgery itself was horrifying to contemplate, but surprisingly simple to perform. I made one quick small incision along the inside corner of the conjunctiva, lifted it slightly with the tip of the needle, and as the worm undulated lazily across the open field, I slipped the tip of the needle under the body and drew it out, neat as a loop of yarn. Repressing a shudder of distaste, I flicked the worm away. It hit the wall with a tiny wet splat and vanished in the shadows under the cheese. There was no blood, After a brief debate with myself, I decided to leave it to the man's own tear ducts to irrigate the incision. That would have to be left to heal by itself. I had no fine sutures, and the wound was small enough not to need more than a stitch or two in any case. I tied a clean pad of cloth over the closed eye with a bandage round the head, and sat back, reasonably pleased with my first foray into tropical medicine. "Fine," I said, pushing back my hair. "Where's the other one?" The next patient was in a shed outside the kitchen, dead. I squatted next to the body, that of a middle-aged man with grizzled hair, feeling both pity and outrage. The cause of death was more than obvious, a strangulated hernia. The loop of twisted, gangrenous bowel protruded from one side of the belly, the stretched skin over it already tinged with green, though the body itself was still nearly as warm as life. An expression of agony was fixed on the broad features, and the limbs were still contorted, giving an unfortunately accurate witness to just what sort of death it had been. "Why did you wait?" I stood up, glaring at Geely. "For God's sake, you kept me drinking tea and chatting while this was going on. He's been dead less than an hour, but he must have been in trouble a long time since. Days! Why didn't you bring me out here at once?" "We seem pretty far gone this morning," she said, not at all disturbed by my agitation. She shrugged. "I've seen them so before. I didn't think you could do anything much. It didn't seem worth hurrying." I choked back further recriminations. She was right. I could have operated had I come sooner, but the chances of it doing any good were slim to non-existent. The hernia repair was something I might have managed, even with such difficult conditions. After all, that was nothing more than pushing back the bowel protrusion and pulling the ruptured layers of abdominal muscle back together with sutures. Infection was the only real danger. But once the loop of escaped intestine had twisted so that the blood supply was cut off and the contents began to putrefy, the man was doomed. But to allow the man to die here in this stuffy shed alone? Well, perhaps he wouldn't have found the presence of one white woman more or less a comfort in any case. Still, I felt an obscure sense of failure, the same I always felt in the presence of death. I wiped my hands slowly on a brandy-soaked cloth, mastering my feelings. One to the good, one to the bad, and Ian still to be found. "Since I'm here now, perhaps I'd best have a look at the rest of your slaves," I suggested. "An ounce of prevention, you know." "Ordered well enough," Geely waved a careless hand. "Still, if you want to take the time, you're welcome. Later, though. I've a visitor coming this afternoon, and I want to talk more with you first. Come back to the house now. Someone will take care of this." A brief nod disposed of this, the slave's contorted body. She linked her arm in mine, urging me out of the shed and back toward the kitchen with soft thrustings of her weight. In the kitchen, I detached myself, motioning toward the pregnant slave, now on her hands and knees scrubbing the hearthstones. "You go along. I want to have a quick look at this girl. She looks a bit toxic to me. You don't want her to miscarry." Geely gave me a curious glance, but then shrugged. "She's fooled twice with no trouble, but you're a doctor." "Aye, if that's your notion of fun, go ahead. Don't take too long, though. That parson said he'd come at 4 o'clock. I made some pretense of examining the bewildered woman until Geely's draperies had disappeared into the breezeway. "Look," I said, "I'm looking for a young white boy named Ian. I'm his aunt. Do you know where he might be?" The girl, she couldn't be more than 17 or 18, looked startled. She blinked and darted a glance at one of the older women who had quit her own work and come across the room to see what was going on. "No, ma'am," the older woman said, shaking her head. "No white boys here, none at all."
"No, ma'am," the girl obediently echoed. "We don't know nothing about your boy."
But she hadn't said that at first, and her eyes wouldn't meet mine. The older woman had been joined now by the other two kitchen maids coming to buttress her. I was surrounded by an impenetrable wall of bland ignorance and no way to break through it. At the same time, I was aware of a current running among the women, a feeling of mutual warning, of wariness and secrecy. It might be only the natural reaction to the sudden appearance of a white stranger in their domain, or it might be something more. I couldn't take longer. Geely would be coming back to look for me. I fumbled quickly in my pocket and pulled out a silver florin, which I pressed into the girl's hand. "If you should see Ian, tell him that his uncle is here to find him." Not waiting for an answer, I turned and hurried out of the kitchen. I glanced down toward the sugar mill as I passed through the breezeway. The sugar press stood abandoned, the oxen grazing placidly in the long grass at the edge of the clearing. There was no sign of Jamie or the overseer. Had he come back to the house? I came through the French windows into the salon and stopped short. Geely sat in her wicker chair, Jamie's coat across her arm, and the photographs of Brianna spread over her lap. She heard my step and looked up, one pale brow arched over an acid smile. "What a pretty lassie, to be sure. What's her name?"
"Brianna."
My lips felt stiff. I walked slowly toward her, fighting the urge to snatch the pictures from her hands and run. "Looks a great deal like her father, doesn't she? I thought she seemed familiar, that tall, red-haired lass I saw that night on Craignadun. He is her father, no?" She inclined her head toward the door where Jamie had vanished. "Yes, give them to me." It made no difference. She had seen the pictures already. Still, I couldn't stand to see her thick white fingers cupping Brianna's face. Her mouth twitched as though she meant to refuse, but she tapped them neatly into a square and handed them to me without demur. I held them against my chest for a moment, not knowing what to do with them, then thrust them back into the pocket of my skirt. "Sit you down, Claire. The coffee's come." She nodded toward the small table and the chair alongside. Her eyes followed me as I moved to it, alive with calculation. She gestured for me to pour the coffee for both of us, and then took her own cup without words. We sipped silently for a few moments. The cup trembled in my hand, spilling hot liquid across my wrist. I put it down, wiping my hand on my skirt, wondering in some dim recess of my mind why I should be afraid. "Twice," she said suddenly. She looked at me with something akin to awe. "Sweet Christ Jesus, you went through twice? Oh no, three times it must have been, for here you are now." She shook her head, marvelling, never taking her bright green eyes from my face. "How?" she asked. "How could you do it so many times and live?" "I don't know." I saw the look of hard scepticism flash across her face and answered it defensively. "I don't. I just went." "Was it not the same for you?" The green eyes had narrowed into slits of concentration. "What was it like there between? Did you not feel the terror and the noise fit to split your skull and spill your brains?" "Yes, it was like that." I didn't want to talk about it, didn't even like to think of the time passage. I had blocked it deliberately from my mind, the roar of death and dissolution, and the voices of chaos that urged me to join them. "Did you have blood to protect you, or stones? I wouldn't think you'd have the nerve for blood, but maybe I'm wrong. For surely you're stronger than I thought to have done it three times and lived through it."
"Blood?"
I shook my head, confused. "No, nothing. I told you. I went. That's all." Then I remembered the night she had gone through the stones in 1968. The blaze of fire on Craignadun, and the twisted blackened shape in the centre of that fire.
"Greg Edgars," I said, the name of her first husband. "You didn't just kill him because he found you and tried to stop you, did you? He was..."
"The blood, aye." She was watching me, intent. "I didn't think it could be done at all, the crossing, not without the blood." She sounded faintly amazed. "The old ones, they always used the blood. That and the fire. They built great wicker cages filled with their captives and set them alight in the circles.
I thought that was how they opened the passage.
My hands and my lips felt cold, and I picked up the cup to warm them. Where in the name of God was Jamie?
And yet didn't he use stones either?
I shook my head.
What stones?
She looked at me for a moment, debating whether to tell me. Her little pink tongue flicked over her lip, and then she nodded, deciding. With a small grunt, she heaved herself up from the chair and went toward the great hearth at the far end of the room, beckoning me to follow. She knelt with surprising grace for one of her figure and pressed a greenish stone set into the mantelpiece a foot or so above the hearth. It moved slightly, and there was a soft click as one of the hearth slates rose smoothly out of its mortared setting.
"Spring mechanism," Geely explained, lifting the slate carefully and setting it aside.
"A Danish fellow named Leven from St. Croix made it for me." She reached into the cavity beneath and drew out a wooden box, about a foot long. There were pale brown stains on the smooth wood, and it looked swollen and split, as though it had been immersed in seawater at some time. I bit my lip hard at its appearance, and hoped my face didn't give anything away. If I had had any doubts about Ian being here, they had vanished. For here, unless I was very much mistaken, was the Silky's treasure. Fortunately, Geely wasn't looking at me, but at the box.
"I learned about the stones from an Indian. Not a red Indian, a Hindu from Calcutta," she explained. "He came to me looking for thorn apple, and he told me about how to make medicines from gemstones."
I looked over my shoulder for Jamie, but there was no sign of him.
Where the hell was he? Had he found Ian somewhere on the plantation?
"You can get the powdered stones from a London apothecary," she was saying, frowning slightly as she pushed at the sliding lid. "But they're mostly poor quality, and the basmus doesn't work so well. Best to have a stone at least of the second quality, what they call a Nagina stone. That's a goodish-sized stone that's been polished. A stone of the first quality is faceted and unflawed for preference, but most folk cannot afford to burn those to ash."
"The ashes of the stone are the basmus," she explained, turning to look up at me.
"That's what you use in the medicines.
Here, can you pry this damn thing loose? It's been spoilt in seawater, and the locking bit swells whenever the weather's damp."
"Which it is all the time, this season of the year," she added, making a face over her shoulder at the clouds rolling in over the bay far below.
She thrust the box into my hands and rose heavily to her feet, grunting with the effort. It was a Chinese puzzle box, I saw. A fairly simple one, with a small sliding panel that unlocked the main lid. The problem was that the smaller panel had swollen, sticking in its slot.
"It's bad luck to break one," Geely observed, watching my attempts. "Else I'd just smash the thing and be done with it.
Here, maybe this will help." She produced a small mother-of-pearl penknife from the recesses of her gown and handed it to me, then went to the window ledge and rang another of her silver bells. I pried gently upward with the blade of the knife. I felt it catch in the wood and wiggled it gingerly. Little by little, the small rectangle of wood edged out of its place until I could get hold of it between thumb and forefinger and pull it all the way loose.
"There you go," I said,
handing her back the box with some reluctance. It felt heavy, and there was an unmistakable metallic chinking as I tilted it.
"Thanks."
As she took it, the black serving maid came in through the far door. Geely turned to order the girl to bring a tray of fresh tarts, and I saw that she had slipped the box between the folds of her skirts, hiding it.
"Nosy creatures," she said, frowning toward the departing maid's back as the girl passed through the door. "One of the difficulties with sleeves, it's hard to have secrets."
She put the box on the table and pushed at the top. With a small, sharp squeak of protest, the lid slid back. She reached into the box and drew out her closed hand. She smiled mischievously at me, saying,
"Little Jackie Horner sat in the corner eating her Christmas pie. She put in her thumb and pulled out a plum."
She opened her hand with a flourish
and said, "What a good girl am I."
I had been expecting them, of course, but had no difficulty in looking impressed anyway.
The reality of a gem is both more immediate and more startling than its description. Six or seven of them flashed and glimmered in her palm, flaming fire and frozen ice, the gleam of blue water in the sun, and a great gold stone like the eye of a lurking tiger. Without meaning to, I drew near enough to look down into the well of her hand, staring with fascination.
Big enough,
Jamie had described them as being, with a characteristic Scottish talent for understatement.
Well, smaller than a bread box, I supposed.
I got them for the money, to start, Geely was saying, prodding the stones with satisfaction, because they were easier to carry than a great weight of gold or silver, I mean.
I didn't think then what other use they might have.
What? Aspasmus? The idea of burning any of those glowing things to ash seemed a sacrilege.
Oh, no, not these.
Her hand closed on the stones, dipped into her pocket, and back into the box for more. A small shower of liquid fire dropped into her pocket, and she patted it affectionately.
No, I've a lot of the smaller stones for that. These are for something else.
She eyed me speculatively, then jerked her head toward the door at the end of the room.
Come along up to my workroom, she said. I've a few things there you'll maybe be interested to see.
Interested was putting it mildly, I thought. It was a long, light-filled room with a counter down one side. Bunches of drying herbs hung from hooks overhead and lay on gauze-covered drying racks along the inner wall. Drawered cabinets and cupboards covered the rest of the wall space, and there was a small glass-fronted bookcase at the end of the room. The room gave me a mild sense of déjà vu. After a moment, I realised that it was because it strongly resembled Geely's workroom in the village of Cranesmuir, in the house of her first husband. No, second, I corrected myself. Remember the flaming body of Greg Edgars.
How many times have you been married?
I asked curiously. She had begun building her fortune with her second husband, Procurator Fiscal of the district where they lived, forging his signature in order to divert money to her own use, and then murdering him. Successful with this modus operandi, I imagine she had tried it again. She was a creature of habit, was Geely Duncan. She paused a moment to count up.
Oh, five, I think, since I came here, she added casually.
Five? I said a little faintly. Not just a habit, it seemed. A positive addiction.
A very unhealthy atmosphere for Englishmen it is in the tropics, she said, and smiled slyly at me. Fevers, ulcers, festering stomachs. Any little thing will carry them off.
She had evidently been mindful of her oral hygiene. Her teeth were still very good. She reached out and lightly caressed a small bottle that stood on the lowest shelf. It wasn't labelled, but I had seen crude white arsenic before. On the whole, I was glad I hadn't taken any food.
Oh, you'll be interested in this, she said, spying a jar on an upper shelf.
Grunting slightly as she stood on tiptoe, she reached it down and handed it to me. It contained a very coarse powder, evidently a mixture of several substances, brown, yellow, and black, flecked with shreds of a semi-translucent material.
What's this?
Zombie poison, she said, and laughed. I thought you'd like to see.
Oh, I said coldly. I thought you told me there was no such thing.
No, she corrected, still smiling. I told you Hercule wasn't dead, and he's not.
She took the jar from me and replaced it on the shelf. But there's no denying that he's a good bit more manageable if he's had a dose of this stuff once a week, mixed with his grain.
What the hell is it?
She shrugged, off-handed. A bit of this and a bit of that. The main thing seems to be a kind of fish. A little square thing with spots. Very funny looking. You take the skin and dry it, and the liver as well. But there are a few other things you put in with it.
I wish I kent what, she added.
You don't know what's in it? I stared at her. Didn't you make it?
No. I had a cook, Geely said. Or at least they sold him to me as a cook. But damned if I'd feel safe eating a thing he turned out of the kitchen, the sly black devil.
He was a Hugon, though.
A what?
Hugon is what the blacks call one of their medicine priests. Though to be quite right about it, I believe Ishmael said his sort of black called him an Onisigan or some such.
Ishmael, hm?
I licked my dry lips.
Did he come with that name?
Oh, no. He had some heathen name with six syllables, and the man who sold him called him Jimmy. The auctioneers call all the bucks Jimmy. I named him Ishmael because of the story the seller told me about him.
Ishmael had been taken from a barracoon on the Gold Coast of Africa, one of a shipment of 600 slaves from the villages of Nigeria and Ghana, stowed between decks of the slave ship Persephone, bound for Antigua. Coming through the Caicos Passage, the Persephone had run into a sudden squall and been run aground on Hogsty Reef, off the island of Great Inagua. The ship had broken up, with barely time for the crew to escape in the ship's boats. The slaves, chained and helpless between decks, had all drowned. All but one man, who had earlier been taken from the hold to assist as a galley mate, both messboys having died of the pox en route from Africa. This man, left behind by the ship's crew, had nonetheless survived the wreck by clinging to a cask of spirits, which floated ashore on Great Inagua 2 days later. The fishermen who discovered the castaway were more interested in his means of salvation than in the slave himself. Breaking open the cask, however, they were shocked and appalled to find inside the body of a man somewhat preserved by the spirits in which he had been soaking. "I wonder if they drank the creme de menthe anyway," I murmured, having observed for myself that Mr. Overholt's assessment of the alcoholic affinities of sailors was largely correct.
"I dare say," said Geely, mildly annoyed at having her story interrupted. "In any case, when I heard of it, I named him Ishmael straight off, because of the floating coffin, aye?"
"Very clever," I congratulated her. "Did they find out who the man in the cask was?"
"I don't think so."
She shrugged carelessly.
"They gave him to the governor of Jamaica, who had him put in a glass case with fresh spirits as a curiosity."
"What?"
I said incredulously. "Well, not so much the man himself, but some odd fungi that were growing on him," Geely explained. "The governor's got a passion for such things. The old governor, I mean. I hear there's a new one now."
"Quite," I said, feeling a bit queasy. I thought the ex-governor was more likely to qualify as a curiosity than the dead man, on the whole. Her back was turned as she pulled out drawers and rummaged through them. I took a deep breath, hoping to keep my voice casual.
"This Ishmael sounds an interesting sort. Do you still have him?"
"No," she said indifferently.
"The black bastard ran off. He's the one who made the zombie poison for me, though. Wouldn't tell me how, no matter what I did to him," she added, with a short, humourless laugh. And I had a sudden vivid memory of the wheels across Ishmael's back. "He said it wasn't proper for women to make medicine. Only men could do it. Oh, they're very old women, once they'd quit bleeding."
She snorted and reached into her pocket, pulling out a handful of stones.
"Anyway, that's not what I brought you up to show you."
Carefully, she laid five of the stones in a rough circle on the countertop. Then she took down from a shelf a thick book bound in worn leather.
"Can you read German?" she asked, opening it carefully.
"Not much, no," I said. I moved closer to look over her shoulder.
"Hexenhammer," it said, in a fine handwritten script.
"Witch's hammer?" I asked. I raised one eyebrow. "Spells? Magic?" The scepticism in my voice must have been obvious, for she glared at me over one shoulder.
"Look, fool," she said. "Who are you? Or what, rather?"
"What am I?" I said, startled.
"That's right."
She turned and leaned against the counter, studying me through narrowed eyes.
"What are you? Or me come to that? What are we?"
I opened my mouth to reply, then closed it again.
"That's right,"
she said softly, watching.
"It's not everyone can go through the stones, is it? Why us?"
"I don't know," I said.
"And neither do you, I'll be bound. It doesn't mean we're witches, surely. Doesn't it?"
She lifted one brow and turned several pages of the book. "Some people can leave their bodies and travel miles away," she said, staring meditatively at the page. "Other people see them out wandering and recognize them, and ye can bloody prove they were really tucked up safe in bed at the time. I've seen the records, all the eyewitness testimony. Some people have stigmata you can see and touch. I've seen one. But not everybody. Only certain people." She turned another page.
"If everyone can do it, it's science.
If only a few can, then it's witchcraft or superstition or whatever you like to call it," she said. "But it's real." She looked up at me, green eyes bright as a snake's over the crumbling book. "We're real, Claire, you and me, and special. Have you never asked yourself why?" I had, any number of times. I had never gotten a reasonable answer to the question, though. Evidently, Geely thought she had one. She turned back to the stones she had laid on the counter and pointed at them each in turn. "Stones of protection. Amethyst, emerald, turquoise, lapis lazuli, and a male ruby."
"A male ruby?"
"Pliny says rubies have a sex to them. Who am I to argue?" she said impatiently. "The male stones are what you use, though. The female ones don't work." I suppressed the urge to ask precisely how one distinguished the sex of rubies in favour of asking, "Work for what?" "For the travel," she said, glancing curiously at me. "Through the stones. They protect you from the... whatever it is out there." Her eyes grew slightly shadowed at the thought of the time passage, and I realised that she was deathly afraid of it. Little wonder. So was I. "When did you come? The first time?" Her eyes were intent on mine. "From 1945, I said slowly. "I came to 1743, if that's what you mean." I was reluctant to tell her too much. Still, my own curiosity was overwhelming. She was right about one thing. She and I were different. I might never again have the chance to talk to another person who knew what she did. For that matter, the longer I could keep her talking, the longer Jamie would have to look for Ian. She grunted in a satisfied manner. "Near enough. It's 200 year in the Highland Tales, when folk fall asleep on fairy duns and end up dancing all night with the old folk. It's usually 200 year later when they come back to their own place."
"You didn't know.
You came from 1968, but you'd been in Cranesmuir several years before I came there."
5 years, aye."
She nodded, abstracted.
"Aye, well, that was the blood."
"Blood? The sacrifice?" she said, suddenly impatient. "It gives you greater range. At least a bit of control, so you have some notion how far you're going."
"How did you get to and fro 3 times without blood?" she demanded.
"I just came." The need to find out as much as I could made me add the little else I knew. I think it has something to do with being able to fix your mind on a certain person who's in the time you go to." Her eyes were nearly round with interest.
"Really?" she said softly. "Think of that now."
She shook her head slowly, thinking.
That might be so. Still, the stone should work as well. There's patterns you meet with the different gems, you ken."
She pulled another fistful of shining stones from her pocket and spread them on the wooden surface, pawing through them. "The protection stones are the points of the pentacle," she explained, intent on her rummaging. "But inside that, you lay the pattern with different stones, depending which way you mean to go and how far. And you lay a line of quicksilver between them, and fire it when you speak the spells. And of course, you draw the pentacle with diamond dust."
"Of course," I murmured, fascinated.
"Smell it?" she asked, looking up for a moment and sniffing. "You wouldn't think stones had a scent, aye? But they do, when you grind them to powder." I inhaled deeply, and did seem to find a faint, unfamiliar scent among the smell of dried herbs. It was a dry scent, pleasant but indescribable, the scent of gemstones. She held up one stone with a small cry of triumph. This one! This is the one I needed! Couldn't find one anywhere in the islands, and finally I thought of the box I'd left in Scotland. The stone she held was a black crystal of some kind. The light from the window passed through it, and yet it glittered like a piece of jet between her white fingers. What is it? An adamant. A black diamond. The old alchemists used them. The books say that to wear an adamant brings you the knowledge of the joy in all things. She laughed, a short, sharp sound, devoid of her usual girlish charm. If anything can bring knowledge or joy in that passage to the stones, I want one. Something was beginning to dawn on me, rather belatedly. In defence of my slowness, I can only argue that I was simultaneously listening to Geely and keeping an ear out for any sign of Jamie returning below. "You mean to go back, then?" I asked, as casually as I could. "I might." A small smile played around the corners of her mouth. "Know that I've got the things I need." "I tell you, Claire, I wouldn't risk it without." She stared at me, shaking her head. "Three times, with no blood," she murmured. "So it can be done." "Well, best we go down now," she said, suddenly brisk, sweeping the stones up and dumping them back into her pocket. "The fox will be back. Fraser is his name, is it no? I thought Clotilda said something else, but the stupid bitch likely got it wrong." As we made our way down the long workroom, something small and brown darted across the floor in front of me. Geely was quick despite her size. Her small foot stamped on the centipede before I could react. She watched the half-crushed beast wriggling on the floor for a moment, then stooped and slid a sheet of paper under it. Scooping it up, she decanted the thing thriftily into a glass jar. "You don't want to believe in witches and zombies and things that go bump in the night," she said, with a small, sly smile at me. She nodded at the centipede, struggling round and round in frenzied, lopsided circles. "Well, legends are many-legged beasties, aye? But they generally have at least one foot on the tooth." She took down a clear brown glass jug and poured the liquid into the centipede's bottle. The pungent scent of alcohol rose in the air. The centipede, washed up by the wave, kicked frantically for a moment, then sank to the bottom of the bottle, legs moving spasmodically. She corked the bottle neatly and turned to go. "You asked me why I thought we can pass through the stones," I said to her back. "Do you know why, Geely?" She glanced over her shoulder at me. "Why? To change things," she said, sounding surprised. "Why else?" "Come along. I hear your man down there." Whatever Jamie had been doing, it had been hard work. His shirt was dampened with sweat and clung to his shoulders. He swung around as we entered the room, and I saw that he had been looking at the wooden puzzle box that Geely had left on the table. It was obvious from his expression that I had been correct in my surmise. It was the box he had found on the Silky's Isle.
"I believe I have succeeded in mending your sugar press, mistress," he said, bowing politely to Geely. "A matter of a cracked cylinder which your overseer and I contrived to stuff with wedges. Still, I fear you may be needing another soon."
Geely quirked her eyebrows, amused.
"Well, and I'm obliged to you, Mr. Fraser. Can I not offer you some refreshment after your labour?"
Her hand hovered over the row of bells, but Jamie shook his head, picking up his coat from the sofa.
"I thank you, mistress, but I fear we must take our leave. It's quite some way back to Kingston, and we must be on our way if we mean to reach it before dark."
His face went suddenly blank, and I knew he must have felt the pocket of his coat and realised that the photographs were missing. He glanced quickly at me, and I gave him a brief nod, touching the side of my skirt where they lay. "Thank you for your hospitality," I said, snatching up my hat and moving toward the door with alacrity. Now that Jamie was back, I wanted nothing so much as to get quickly away from Rose Hall and its owner. Jamie hung back a moment, though.
I wondered, Mistress Abernethy, since you mentioned having lived in Paris for a time, whether you might have been acquainted there with a gentleman of my own acquaintance. Did you by chance ken the Duke of Sandringham?
She cocked her cream-blonde head at him inquisitively, but as he said no more, she nodded.
Aye,
I kent him. Why?
Jamie gave her his most charming smile.
No particular reason, mistress. Only a curiosity, you might see.
The sky was completely overcast by the time we passed the gate, and it was clear that we weren't going to make it back to Kingston without getting soaked. Under the circumstances, I didn't care.
"You've got Brianna's pictures,"
was the first thing Jamie asked, reining up for a moment.
"Right here,"
I patted my pocket. "Did you find any sign of Ian?" He glanced back over his shoulder, as though fearing we might be pursued.
"I couldn't get anything out of the overseer or any of the slaves. They're bone scared of that woman, and I canna say I blame them a bit. But I know where he is."
He spoke with considerable satisfaction. "Where? Can we sneak back and get him?" I rose slightly in my saddle, looking back. The slates of Rose Hall were all that was visible through the treetops. I would have been most reluctant to set foot on the place again for any reason, except for Ian.
"Not now."
Jamie caught at my bridle, turning the horse's head back to the trail.
"I'll need help."
Under the pretext of finding material to repair the damaged sugar press, Jamie had managed to see most of the plantation within a quarter mile of the house, including a cluster of slave huts, the stables, a disused drying shed for tobacco, and the building that housed the sugar refinery. Every place he went, he suffered no interference beyond curious or hostile glances, except near the refinery.
"That big black bugger who came up onto the porch was sitting on the ground outside," he said. "When I got too close to him, it made the overseer very nervous indeed. He kept calling me away, warning me not to get too close to the fellow."
"That sounds like a really excellent idea," I said, shuddering slightly. "Not getting close to him, I mean. But you think he has something to do with Ian?"
"He was sitting in front of a wee door fixed into the ground, Sassenach."
Jamie guided his horse adroitly around a fallen log in the path.
"It must lead to a cellar beneath the refinery."
The man hadn't moved an inch in all the time that Jamie contrived to spend around the refinery.
"If Ian's there, that's where he is."
"I'm fairly sure he's there, all right," I told him quickly the details of my visit, including my brief conversation with the kitchen maids. "But what are we going to do?" I concluded.
"We can't just leave him there. After all, we don't know what Gillis wants with him. But it can't be innocent if she wouldn't admit he was there, can it?"
"Not innocent at all," he agreed, grim-faced. "The overseer wouldn't speak to me of Ian, but he told me other things that would curl your hair if it wasn't already curled up like sheep's wool."
He glanced at me, and a half-smile lit his face, in spite of his obvious perturbation.
"Judging by the state of your hair, Sassenach, I should see that it's going to rain very soon now."
"How observant of you," I said sarcastically, vainly trying to tuck in the curls and tendrils that were escaping from under my hat.
"The fact that the sky's black as pitch and the air smells like lightning wouldn't have a thing to do with your conclusions, of course." The leaves of the trees all round us were fluttering like tethered butterflies as the edge of the storm rose toward us up the slope of the mountain. From the small rise where we stood, I could see the storm clouds sweep in across the bay below, with a dark curtain of rain hanging beneath it like a veil. Jamie rose in his saddle, looking over the terrain. To my unpracticed eye, our surroundings looked like solid, impenetrable jungle, but other possibilities were visible to a man who had lived in the heather for 7 years.
"We'd best find a bit of shelter while we can, Sassenach," he said. "Follow me."
On foot, leading the horses, we left the narrow path and pressed into the forest, following what Jamie said was a wild pig's trail. Within a few moments he had found what he was looking for, a small stream that cut deep through the forest floor, with a steep bank overgrown with ferns and dark glossy bushes, interspersed with strands of slender saplings. He set me to gathering ferns, each frond the length of my arm, and by the time I had returned with as many as I could carry, he had the framework of a tidy snug, formed by the arch of the bent saplings, tied to a fallen log, and covered over with branches cut from the nearby bushes. Hastily roofed with the spread ferns, it wasn't quite waterproof, but a great deal better than being caught in the open. 10 minutes later, we were safe inside. There was a moment of absolute quiet as the wind on the edge of the storm passed by us. No birds chattered. No insects sang. They were as well equipped as we were to predict the rain. A few large drops fell, splattering on the foliage with an explosive sound like snapping twigs. Then the storm broke. Caribbean rainstorms are abrupt and vigorous. None of the misty mousing about of an Edinburgh drizzle. The heavens blacken and split, dropping gallons of water within a minute. For as long as the rain lasts, speech is impossible, and a light fog rises from the ground like steam, vapour raised by the force of the raindrops striking the ground. The rain pelted the ferns above us, and a faint mist filled the green shadows of our shelter. Between the clatter of the rain and the constant thunder that boomed among the hills, it was impossible to talk. It wasn't cold, but there was a leak overhead which dripped steadily on my neck. There was no room to move away. Jamie took off his coat and wrapped it around me, then put his arm around me to wait out the storm. In spite of the terrible racket outside, I felt suddenly safe and peaceful, relieved of the strain of the last few hours, the last few days. Ian was as good as found, and nothing could touch us here. I squeezed his free hand. He smiled at me, then bent and kissed me gently. He smelled fresh and earthy, scented with the sap of the branches he had cut, and the smell of his own healthy sweat. It was nearly over, I thought. We had found Ian, and, God willing, would get him back safely very soon. And then what? We would have to leave Jamaica, but there were other places, and the world was wide. There were the French colonies of Martinique and Grenada, the Dutch-held island of Eleuthera. Perhaps we would even venture as far as the continent, cannibals notwithstanding. So long as I had Jamie, I wasn't afraid of anything. The rain ceased as abruptly as it had started. Drops fell singly from the shrubs and trees, with a pitter-pat drip that echoed the ringing left in my ears by the storm's roar. A soft, fresh breeze came up the stream bed, carrying away humidity, lifting the damp curls from my neck with delicious coolness. The birds and the insects began again quietly, and then in full voice, and the air itself seemed to dance with green life. I stirred and sighed, pushing myself upright and shrugging off Jamie's coat. You know, Gilly showed me a special stone. A black diamond called an adamant, I said. She said it's a stone the alchemists used. It gives a knowledge of the joy in all things. I think there might be one under this spot. Jamie smiled at me.
I shouldn't be surprised at all, Sassenach, he said. Here, you've water all down your face.
He reached into his coat for a handkerchief, then stopped.
Brianna's pictures, he said suddenly.
Oh, I forgot. I dug in my pocket and handed him back the pictures. He took them and thumbed rapidly through them, stopped, then went through them again, more slowly.
What's wrong? I asked, suddenly alarmed.
One of them's gone, he said quietly.
I felt an inexpressible feeling of dread begin to grow in the pit of my stomach, and the joy of a moment before began to ebb away.
Are you sure?
I know them as well as I know your face, Sassenach, he said. I am sure. That's the one of her by the fire.
I remembered the picture in question well. It showed Brianna as an adult sitting on a rock outdoors by a campfire. Her knees were drawn up, her elbows resting on them, and she was looking directly into the camera, but with no knowledge of its presence. Her face filled with firelit dreams, her hair blown back away from her face.
Gailey must have taken it.
She found the pictures in your coat while I was in the kitchen, and I took them away from her. She must have stolen it then.
Damn the woman!
Jamie turned sharply to look toward the road, eyes dark with anger. His hand was tight on the remaining photographs.
What does she want with it?
Perhaps it's only curiosity, I said. But the feeling of dread wouldn't go away.
What could she do with it, after all?
She isn't likely to show it to anyone. Who would come here? As though in answer to this question, Jamie's head lifted suddenly, and he grasped my arm in adjuration to be still. Some distance below, a loop of the road was visible through the overgrowth, a thin ribbon of yellowish mud. Along this ribbon came a plodding figure on horseback, a man dressed in black, small and dark as an ant at this distance. Then I remembered what Gailey had said. I'm expecting a visitor. And later, that parson said he'd come up 4 o'clock.
It's a parson, a minister of some kind, I said. She said she was expecting him.
It's Archie Campbell is who it is,
Jamie said with some grimness.
What the devil? Or perhaps I shouldn't have used that particular expression with respect to Mistress Duncan.
Maybe he's come to exercise her, I suggested with a nervous laugh.
He's his work cut out for him, if so.
The angular figure disappeared into the trees, but it was several minutes before Jamie deemed him safely past us.
What do you plan to do about Ian?
I asked, once we had made our way back to the path.
I'll need help, he answered briskly. I mean to come up the river with Innes and MacLeod and the rest. There's a landing there, no great distance from the refinery. We'll leave the boat there, go ashore, and deal with Hercules and Atlas, too, if he's a mind to be troublesome. Break open the cellar, snatch ye in, and make off again. The darker the moon's in 2 days. I wish it could be sooner, but it will likely take that long to get a suitable boat and what arms we'll need.
Using what for money?
I inquired bluntly. The expenditure for new clothes and shoes had taken a substantial portion of Jamie's share of profit from the bat guano.
What was left would feed us for several weeks, and possibly be sufficient to rent a boat for a day or two. But it wouldn't stretch to buying large quantities of weapons.
Neither pistols nor swords were manufactured on the island. All weapons were imported from Europe, and were, in consequence, expensive. Jamie himself had Captain Raines's 2 pistols. The Scots had nothing but their fish knives and the odd cutlass, insufficient for an armed raid. He grimaced slightly, then glanced at me sidelong.
"I must ask John for help," he said simply. "Must I not?"
I rode silently for a moment, then nodded in acquiescence. "I suppose you'll have to." I didn't like it. But it wasn't a question of my liking. It was Ian's life.
"One thing, though, Jamie."
"Aye, I know," he said, resigned. "You mean to come with me, no?"
"Yes," I said, smiling. "After all, what if Ian's hurt or sick or..."
"Aye, ye can come," he said, rather testily. "Only do me the one wee favour, Sassenach. Try very hard not to be killed or cut to pieces, aye? It's hard on a man's sensibilities."
"I'll try," I said circumspectly, and nudging my horse closer to his, rode side by side down toward Kingston, through the dripping trees. Chapter 61. The Crocodile's Fire. There was a surprising amount of traffic on the river at night. Lawrence Stern, who had insisted on accompanying the expedition, told me that most of the plantations up in the hills used the river as their main linkage with Kingston and the harbour. Roads were either atrocious or non-existent, swallowed by lush growth with each new rainy season. I had expected the river to be deserted, but we passed 2 small craft and a barge headed downstream as we tacked laboriously up the broad waterway under sail. The barge, An immense dark shape, stacked high with casks and bales, passed us like a black iceberg, huge, humped, and threatening. The low voices of the slaves poling it carried across the water, talking softly in a foreign tongue.
"That was kind of you to come, Lawrence," Jamie said.
We had a small, single-masted open boat which barely held Jamie, myself, the six Scottish smugglers, and Stern. Despite the crowded quarters, I too was grateful for Stern's company. He had a stolid, phlegmatic quality about him that was very comforting under the circumstances.
"Well, I confess to some curiosity," Stern said, flapping the front of his shirt to cool his sweating body.
In the dark, all I could see of him was a moving blotch of white.
"I have met the lady before, you see."
"Mrs. Abernathy?" I paused and asked delicately, "what do you think of her?"
"Oh, she was a very pleasant lady. Most gracious."
Dark as it was, I couldn't see his face, but his voice held an odd note, half pleased, half embarrassed, that told me he had found the widow Abernathy quite attractive indeed. From which I concluded that Geely had wanted something from the naturalist. I had never known her treat a man with any regard, save for her own ends.
"Where did you meet her? At her own house?"
According to the attendees at the governor's ball, Mrs. Abernathy seldom or never left her plantation.
"Yes, at Rose Hall. I had stopped to ask permission to collect a rare type of beetle, one of the Curculionidae, that I had found near a spring on the plantation. She invited me in and made me most welcome."
This time there was a definite note of self-satisfaction in his voice. Jamie, handling the tiller next to me, heard it and snorted briefly.
"What did she want of you?" he asked,
no doubt having formed conclusions similar to mine about Geely's motives and behaviour.
"Oh, she was most gratifyingly interested in the specimens of flora and fauna I had collected on the island. She asked me about the locations and virtues of several different herbs. Ah, and about the other places I had been. She was particularly interested in my stories of Hispaniola."
He sighed, momentarily regretful.
"It is difficult to believe that such a lovely woman might engage in such reprehensible behaviour as you describe, James."
"Lovely, eh?" Jamie's voice was dryly amused.
"A bit smitten, were you, Lawrence?"
Lawrence's voice echoed Jamie's smile.
"There is a sort of carnivorous fly I have observed, friend James. The male fly, choosing a female to court, takes pains to bring her a bit of meat or other prey, tidily wrapped in a small silk package. While the female is engaged in unwrapping her tidbit, he leaps upon her, performs his copulatory duties, and hastens away. For if she should finish her meal before he has finished his own activities, or should he be so careless as not to bring her a tasty present, she eats him."
There was a soft laugh in the darkness.
"No, it was an interesting experience, but I think I shall not call upon Mrs. Abernathy again."
"Not if we're lucky about it, no," Jamie agreed.
The men left me by the river bank to mind the boat and melted into the darkness with instructions from Jamie to stay put. I had a primed pistol given to me with the stern injunction not to shoot myself in the foot. The weight of it was comforting, but as the minutes dragged by in black silence, I found the dark and the solitude more and more oppressive. From where I stood, I could see the house, a dark oblong with only the lower three windows lighted. That would be the salon, I thought, and wondered why there was no sign of any activity by the slaves. As I watched, though, I saw a shadow cross one of the lighted windows, and my heart jumped into my throat.
It wasn't Geely's shadow, by any conceivable stretch of the imagination.
It was tall, thin, and gawkily angular.
I looked wildly around, wanting to call out, but it was too late. The men were all out of earshot, headed for the refinery.
I hesitated for a moment, but there was really nothing else to do. I kilted up my skirts and stepped into the dark. By the time I stepped onto the veranda, I was damp with perspiration and my heart was beating loudly enough to drown out all other sounds. I edged silently next to the nearest window, trying to peer in without being seen from within. Everything was quiet and orderly within. There was a small fire on the hearth, and the glow of the flames gleamed on the polished floor. Gilly's rosewood secretary was